Well, good evening, my dearly loved brethren and sisters in our Lord Jesus Christ. Might I say what my intention tonight is not to go back really into 2 Samuel 20. We basically got through the majority of that story. The story ends, as we know, with the Sheba being killed, his head being thrown over the wall by the work of a wise woman. And Joab departs and comes back down to Jerusalem. And that chapter, that attempt at another insurrection, it was brought quickly to an end through the wisdom of that woman and the fast action of the army. We will have chance to come back to parts of that chapter a little later, because we haven't actually finished with Joab, I can tell you that. Joab is yet alive and well in the story, and we will meet Joab again and make a summary of him towards the end when he appears again. So we will return, because I think 2 Samuel 20 is very instructive in terms of Joab's character, and that's probably where we just would have spent the last little bit of last class dealing with that. But we'll leave that for tonight and move on to this next part of the story. But I just want you to turn to chapter 20 and verse 23, because there's a little statement here. Now, Joab was over all the host of Israel, which might in itself be highly surprising, considering what Joab had just done in this previous chapter, in that chapter. And Benaiah, the son of Jehoiada, over the Cherethites, Pelethites, and so on. And it gives a list there of David's administration. And there's a list of all of those who we might actually call his cabinet, certainly some of the most important administrators in his government. And it's almost exactly the same when you compare it with 2 Samuel chapter 8, when we had another list at the time when David had established his authority in the land. The enemies largely had been suppressed. Not all the enemies had been defeated, but largely that had been the case, and the land had rest and the people were prosperous because there was wise and godly government, a king who honoured God above all. And now we find this statement coming here again with almost the same people, with the addition of a couple of people, and you can see them in blue here. Adoram, who was now over the forced labour, the tribute of forced labour. And largely that wasn't necessary, because much of the force of foreign people who were working in Israel for the government and the tribute that was coming in was not actually coming into the nation earlier, but now it is, and it was necessity to put someone in charge of that. And the other significant change here is his chief rulers or advisors were previously his sons, but as we know, there was significant difficulty with that. Absalom is now dead, and his two of his other sons are dead as well. And he's now got Ira, who we find here is a Gerite, who was chief ruler or chief advisor to David. But I think what this is telling us, just this statement of his government, of his cabinet here, is that the nation, after the horrendous period through which they had passed with Absalom's insurrection and then Sheba's insurrection, a period of around about 12 years, we now actually have got a period of stability returning to the kingdom. A period of stability like there had been before. And from this time forward, that seems to be the case. We don't know a lot of details of what happened in just those last 10 years exactly of David's life and in the specific sequence of things, but it certainly seems as though the nation settled quite considerably. Now, it wasn't that David and the nation didn't face difficulties. That's certainly what did happen. But, and we have evidence of that, we'll come to that as we move on. But at this point, the turmoil of those earlier years is now, for David, for a while, over. And then we meet chapter 21, which is one of these stories that I can relate in my own experience, having read this, you know, years ago and thinking, what on earth is this all about? And until you spend some time untangling it, you might still actually think that. Well, one commentator said this. There's a calamity here that was absolutely remarkable. The cause was remarkable, and the cure was even more remarkable than either of those. And it's true. I think it's just such a puzzling and amazing and challenging little story in its own right. And the chapter starts by saying, then there was a famine in the days of David. Now, the word then is actually doesn't, the Hebrew at that point does not mean now, after all of that that's gone on, then this happens. It doesn't actually mean that, whereas we get that from the English here. In many translations, it just says, you know, and there was a famine in the days of David. It's not necessarily saying this immediately followed the insurrection of Sheba. It's actually quite a challenge to work out when exactly it did happen. And I might make a few suggestions tonight, but I'm not going to be dogmatic about that. But before we look at anything in the chapter itself, just let's look first of all at the overall big picture. Yes, what have we got? This is the big picture of chapter 21 to 24, the rest of 2 Samuel. This is, if we just look at the whole of this next section of David's life, it's fairly clear to me that we actually have another chiastic structure. Now, you know what a chiastic structure is, because we looked at one before. But the interesting thing about this is, if you just turn over to chapter 24, verse 1, it says, "And again the anger of Yahweh was kindled against Israel." Again the anger of Yahweh was kindled. So the anger of Yahweh is kindled somewhere previous to this. And then when you look down to the end of that chapter, 2 Samuel 24, David built an altar unto Yahweh, offered burnt offerings and peace offerings. So Yahweh was entreated for the land, and the plague was stayed from Israel. So the story of chapter 24 starts with saying God was angry with Israel. It ends by saying God was entreated for the land, and the plague was over. Right? Now come back to chapter 21. Because what do we find at the start of chapter 21? We find there's a famine in the days of David, sometime year after year. In fact, it's 3 years at least. Now, in Israel's economy, that would have been extremely difficult to cope with. I mean, if we had a famine for 3 years in Australia, it would put pressure, but we would still have food because we'd import it from some other country in the world, you know, which they were not able to do, in that just common people weren't able to do. So it was an extremely difficult situation. And the one thing we find, and if you like to just jot something in your margin there, there's a myriad of places in the law and in the historical sections of the Old Testament that tell us what famines were about. And famines came, particularly long and extended famines, were God's hand upon the nation for something that had actually gone on. They were an evidence of God's wrath. If you want some proof, Deuteronomy chapter 11, verse 17 says so. So does 1 Kings 8, 35. And it's all the way through Deuteronomy 28 and Leviticus 26. So there's plenty of evidence to suggest that famines were used by God, the stopping of rain and the consequent, no food, was used by God to show his displeasure. Just like rain was a sign of his blessing and his favour, so the stopping of rain showed his displeasure. And here for 4 years, the land was in famine. This has got angry with the people and the nation. And even David actually thought after a time. See, it says year after year it went on. And eventually it got so bad that David thought, I think this is, God is telling us something here. And he went to inquire of Yahweh. And God said, yes, David, you're right. Something is wrong. So it wasn't an accident. It wasn't just bad seasons. God was angry with the nation. And now look at verse 14, right at the end, and it says, and after that, after all this chapter takes place, and after that, God was entreated for the land. Now, if you've got a colour pencil, you should colour that in, as well as the last verse of chapter 24, because here is a little pattern. We've got God angry with the people and sending a famine, and then he's entreated for the land, and then later he's angry again with Israel, and he sends pestilence, and then he's entreated for the land. Now, that's the start of this structure here. God is angry with Israel, and he's angry with Israel later. But what we find in the middle is that the record of chapter 21 to 24 goes on to say, well, here's a list of details of in the rest of chapter 21 of a number of battles with the Philistines, but it particularly focuses on some of his mighty men killing giants. In the whole battle, we don't know the whole details about the battle, but we actually know about some specific people who were attacking specific giants or pulled down specific giants. And then we have that amazing psalm of deliverance recorded in full, which is then followed by David's last words, very poetic. Both of those sections are very poetic. And then on the end of that, surprisingly, why was this not put in a different order? We have a list of David's mighty men, almost the complete list, or it is a complete list of David's mighty men. And then we get this Yahweh angry with Israel again in another situation. Now, when we were having a look at a chiastic structure once before, a couple of classes ago, the purpose of these structures where they do occur is to focus our attention at something. Now, I'm not going to go into that now. We'll come back to that at a later stage, and it probably won't be until the start of next year, God willing, before we do. But it's worth you actually having a look and seeing what you make of that, because the Spirit has written this and penned this history in a particular way to focus the attention of an audience who is reading or hearing it. And what was the point? What were they meant to get? What are we meant to get from that? But I'll leave it at that point. So let's go back to verse 1, where we find that in the days of David, we're not told exactly when. It just says very vaguely in the days of David. And I suppose in one sense it doesn't actually really matter. Now, if we make the assumption, which largely is true through most of the record of David's life, and most of the historical records, in fact, of through Samuel and Kings and so on, they are largely chronological. But it's not to say that things could not be slightly out of chronological order for a particular purpose. Particularly to make a conclusion to a particular matter in someone's life or whatever. But I suppose I'd have to say that I think my thinking has always been that largely is chronological. And so it may well be that this 3 years of famine and the events of chapter 21 actually did occur following the revolt of Sheba. So the nation settled down, but then there was another circumstance here. But it is also distinctly possible that this famine could actually have occurred before the revolt of Absalom. And the reason I say that is because there's some little hints in the record around the place. There are only hints. There are only little statements that we can either take up or not. But one of those comes out of the mouth of Shimei, who calls David a man of blood, and he goes off. He's from Benjamin, and he accuses David of destroying the house of Saul. In effect, you think, maybe this circumstance had actually occurred before that, and that was a reference to it. Anyway, I don't think there's much point us getting into that in a lot of detail. I'm happy to have a conversation with anyone afterwards about some of those details, but I don't think they're central to the real purpose of this story itself. But this famine just got worse and worse year after year. And I suppose if, you know, seasons were just a bit erratic, and none of us think very much about it, and David didn't, but as it went on year after year, and that's when he went and inquired of Yahweh, probably through the priest using Urim and Thummim, as David had done on a number of occasions when he was in the wilderness. So we know that David had used that means in the past, and probably what he did here. And he's told, yes, David, this famine is no accident. This is for Saul and his house of blood because he slew the Gibeonites. I think David would have been, you know, well, what do we know what David thought? You know, I think that if what this chapter says, that Saul had actually slaughtered many of the Gibeonites, clearly not all because there's still some alive here that David's speaking to, but it must have been pretty horrendous, then what's he going to do now? You know, what's David's reaction to this? I think it's highly likely that many people in the nation knew something of it, which might explain why this is a famine. This is a national calamity. God is not just targeted a single person or a person's house, though he's identified where the problem came from. But the rest of the nation, at least some of the rest of the nation, must have known that a whole bunch of the Gibeonites were actually killed, because they were hewers of wood and drawers of water to the people, and particularly in service for the tabernacle. Now, that must have affected the worship. It must have affected a number of things. And, yeah, I don't think that you could slaughter a whole set of families like the Gibeonites were, and a large number of people, without the nation, at least some in the nation, knowing about it. So, well, we have no particular record of that at all. There's just nothing in the historical record about anything like that in Saul's life. There is the incident you'll remember in Saul's life when he tries to kill all the priesthood, and none of his own men would even be involved in that, even though he asked them to slay the priests. And it was Doeg who got his henchmen onto them and slaughtered them. And it's only a suggestion that it possibly could have been around that time, because the Gibeonites were closely associated with the worship of the tabernacle. They were providing water and wood for the offerings and for the washing and so on in the tabernacle. And it may well have been that Saul got very zealous at the time. But a bit more of that later. Whatever happened here, as soon as David heard that, he took this incredibly seriously, because in verse 3, he says, "Wherewith shall I make the atonement that ye may bless the inheritance of Yahweh?" David saw this as a matter of national atonement. He saw that if God had actually stopped the rain to the entire nation, this was no minor matter. This was a very, very serious matter that the whole nation had to take notice of, because God did not bring his judgments willy-nilly across the entire nation without there being some good cause. So, you know that we know the words well. We don't need to turn them up now in Exodus 34 when it describes the character of God. What it goes on to say is that he will not clear the guilty, but he will visit the iniquity of the fathers upon the children and upon the children's children unto the third and fourth generation. Now, we might think that in our modern Western thinking that that's sort of not very fair. But in actual fact, it's just part of life, and it always has been. The consequences, God is not holding individuals responsible for an individual sin, but the consequences of fathers' bad decisions and of leaders' bad decisions does flow to another generation. It does, inevitably, and we find multiple examples of that in the Bible. But that statement in Exodus 34 is a statement of God's mercy, because it says that while the God will visit the iniquity of the fathers upon the children and the children's children, there is a limit to that in God's view. His mercy will limit it to the third or fourth generation, and it will not go further. Even though the natural consequences might have it going much further and wiping out whole peoples, or whole tribes, or the nation itself. Well, the details of this calamity are quite staggering. This is what we find. Look in verse 1, we're told that he slew the house, Saul, and his house of blood, because that's how God saw Saul's family. Now, that's really worth taking notice of right at the start, that this is not just Saul. It's Saul and his family, who God says are a house of blood. And they'd slain Gibeonites. That's the first thing. Verse 2, we find that it says, halfway through that it says, "And the children of Israel had sworn to them, and Saul sought to slay them in his zeal to the children of Israel and Judah." Interesting. What did that mean? Well, here's Saul showing zeal for the nation of Israel and Judah, so not just his own tribe, but others as well, and he's trying to impress people with how zealous he is and how wonderfully he's working for them, and in the process he slays, massacres the Gibeonites. This man, as we know, was erratic, and at times he could be touched, his conscience could be touched, and the next minute he was swung in 180 degrees, chasing the most godly man on earth and trying to kill him as if he was a dead dog. There was incredible instability in this man. And here I think we're seeing another instance of it, because when it came to him obeying God, Samuel came to him and said, "Now I want you to do what God wants, and I want you to go and get the Amalekites and slay every last one of them." And when he comes back, he's got the king of the Amalekites, he's got all their sheep, he's got all these people. And Samuel despairs and said, "This is rebellion." So here God says, "Slay this," and he doesn't. And now God says about the Gibeonites, who they'd made an oath with Joshua 400 years before, that they were to live and be part of Israel. God says, "Don't, whatever you do, kill them." And now he's slaughtering them. This is just bizarre that this could even happen. But it happened. And so the next thing we find is in verse 5, when they are asked by David what happened and what he wants them, what he shall do for them, they answered the king and said, "The man that consumed us, destroyed," it means, "and that devised against us that we should be destroyed from remaining any of the coasts of Israel." Here on the screen, I've actually got another translation. I think it's the... it's a combination of the NIV and the International New Version. And it says, "He planned their destruction and intended to leave them with nothing in the territory of Israel." He was determined that if he didn't actually kill all of them, they were going to be driven completely outside, completely nothing to do with Israel. That's his intention. At least that was their perception of it. And they are the victims of this. And they have got many of their own families that have been killed, no doubt. when they're talking to David at this point. This is an incredibly serious matter, because it sounds like genocide, doesn't it, when you just read the story. It's wrongly motivated zeal, and because it was zeal for Israel and Judah, it is highly likely that many in Israel and Judah knew about this massacre, or at least parts of it. They might have not have known the full extent of it. But it may well have been that they were the beneficiaries as well, because Saul even spoke like that on one occasion. You know, will David give you vineyards and lands like I give you? Where did he get lands and vineyards from? Maybe it was all part of what he was doing. Thinking in his warped sense of right and justice that these Hivites shouldn't even be in the land, so let's get rid of them and let's have the benefits. And I, as the king, will give you the benefits, Judah and Israel. You will have all the benefits of this. It's just an amazing thing. But, you know, it's even more serious than just like a genocide, isn't it? Because of what verse 2 says, and we know very well is true from the record of the Gibeonites anyway, back in Joshua. We'll turn to that in just a second. But we're told there in parenthesis in verse 2, the Gibeonites were not of the children of Israel, but of the remnant of the Amorites, and the children of Israel had sworn unto them. Sworn unto them that they should live. And in violation of a covenant of Yahweh, this man and his house has now slaughtered them. David has on his hands, brothers and sisters, an amazingly challenging experience. Like, how would you cope with something like this? That, you know, all ecclesial problems just pale into insignificance here. The whole nation's involved in this. There are people in your own country that are now on the point of death because they're just about starving. And possibly some had died. Who knows? But let's just go, hold your hand there in 2 Samuel, and just go back to Joshua 9 for a minute, which is where the story really starts, I suppose, with the Gibeonites. And we know the story. They deceive Joshua and the elders. And the Gibeonites were actually Hivites, and they were a peace-loving folk. They were very unlike many of the other tribes and kingdoms in the land, the other Amorites, who were very often very warlike. The Canaanites were very warlike. But in verse 14 we read, and then the men took of their victuals and asked not counsel at the mouth of Yahweh. Joshua didn't, but David had on this occasion. And Joshua made peace with them and made a league with them and let them live. And the princes of the congregation swear unto them. And over in verse 18, and all the children of Israel smote them not, because the princes of the congregation had sworn unto them by Yahweh Elohim of Israel, by the covenant name of God. And look what verse 20 goes on to say. This will we do unto them. We will even let them live. Well, they didn't have much choice, because they'd already sworn by Yahweh that they would. Lest wrath be upon us because of the oath which we swear unto them. So Joshua wouldn't dare touch those people now, even though he'd been deceived by them. He wouldn't dare touch them because they had sworn an oath before Yahweh, and that was utterly binding for all time. And he said, if we touch them, wrath will be upon us, which is exactly what we're finding in 2 Samuel chapter 21. But before we leave this, let's have a look at verse 21. And the princes said unto them, let them live, but let them be hewers of wood and drawers of water unto all the congregation. And that's we're given a little bit more detail in verse 23 and over again in verse 27 as to how that was actually going to be worked out. But they were to be the lowest of the low. And verse 23 tells us, "Now therefore ye are cursed, and there shall none of you be free from bondmen. You're just going to be hewers of wood and drawers of water for the house of my God." You are going to be always bondmen. You're always going to be slaves. You are cursed. Now, the word cursed, in fact, is the same word that's translated through Joshua as devoted. The city of Jericho was devoted to God. That's exactly what it means. And so they were not cursed in the sense that everyone had to curse them as they went past. They were given to the nation and to the Levites as servants. That's actually what it means. So they weren't to be a curse in a sense. They were a blessing to the nation in a sense because they were going to be servants. And while they had deceived Joshua and the elders, it's really amazing that they had believed the reports that they'd heard about Israel and Israel's God, and they wanted, desperately wanted, to be on Yahweh's side and not on the side of the rest of the nations in there. And 400 years later, after that deception, which was motivated really by their belief about the reports about Israel's God that they heard. In that sense, they were very similar to Rahab, who had heard these reports and believed them and didn't want to be left in Jericho. Well, they didn't either. 400 years later, they're still in the nation, still servants. They still haven't climbed up the ranks and started dictating to people what to do. They haven't left the nation. They haven't left Israel. They're still there, right in the middle. And then Saul irrationally plans to and implements their destruction. What an amazing thing. You know, those people who were the lowest of the low, the servants of the servants in Israel, had no rights. They were poor. Their lands had been taken from them. They were to live from the tithes that came to the Levites, and after 3 years' famine, you can imagine how much of those were coming in. And they must have cried to Yahweh, because God said in the law numerous times, "If the poor and the needy cry unto me, or if you do anything to anyone that makes them in the poor and needy class, and they cry unto me, I can rest assured that I will hear them and I will act," says God. But I think what we're seeing in Samuel 21, 2 Samuel 21, is God acting. Because these Gibeonites had cried out to him. So come back to 2 Samuel 21 and in verse 3 and 4, I'd just like to read this from the ESV, because it does actually change the sense of verse 4, and I think this is more in keeping with the meaning of it. It's a little obscure, and I think doesn't quite give the right sense here. But so David said to the Gibeonites, "What shall I do for you, and how shall I make atonement that you may bless the heritage of Yahweh?" And the Gibeonites said to him, "It is not a matter of silver or gold between us and Saul or his house. Neither is it for us to put any man to death in Israel." So David asked them what they wanted him to do, and they didn't tell him, you notice. They said, "We don't want money. We don't want financial compensation. And it's not up to us to put anyone to death." They said what they didn't want to do and what they wouldn't do. And so he said, that is David, "Well, what do you say that I shall do for you?" David's listening very, very, very carefully. But you know what? I think David immediately realized this was a matter of national atonement, because these people had been seriously wronged and many of their families had been murdered. They had every right not to bless the inheritance of Yahweh because of what had been done to them from a natural point of view, and to speak evil of the truth, and to speak evil of Israel, and of Israel's God. But we find none of that happening. We don't find that occurring here, brothers and sisters. You know, it's a real lesson, isn't it? Because here's a people who were just slaves, who accepted their position, but they didn't badmouth. They didn't, even when many of their own people had been murdered unjustly, they are still not going out for revenge. They don't want silver or gold as compensation, like was very common in the nations at the time. They just didn't feel it was their place to seek revenge. As after 400 years incorporated into that nation, they've still got a lowly view of their position, and they're still trying to do it. And verse 5 and 6 says, after David says, well, come on, tell me what you want, what you think you want me to do. Because David is being already quite impressed by what he's hearing here. And verse 5 says, and they answered the king, the man that consumed us and devised against us that we should be destroyed from remaining in any of the coasts, let 7 men of his sons be delivered to us, and we will hang them up unto Yahweh and Gibeah of Saul, whom Yahweh did choose. And the king said, I'll give them. You know, we can just read straight past that, brothers and sisters. That's a remarkable verse, that last verse. They said, well, since you asked us, we think that 7 men of his sons should be hung up. Rotherham says, crucified unto Yahweh. And David's response was immediate. He says, I will give them. How could David, in the midst of this, what was this going to mean? He was going to have to go to Saul's house, and he was going to have to choose some of his sons and tell them that they were going to have to die. They were going to be hung up before the nation, as if that was going to be an easy job to do. Whether he could even manage to do it, it was just fraught with so many difficulties. And yet immediately he is absolutely sure that whatever these Gibeonites have asked for is right. And this is why. Because when we look at these Gibeonites, you just take this record and extract out what we know about them, it's just an utterly amazing picture. They suffered unjustly with no attempt at revenge. They wanted no financial compensation. They exercised no rights of revenge. Even though, because they were in the nation of Israel, if someone had murdered someone, they had the right to pursue that person and take their life unless they got to a city of refuge, and Saul and his sons were not living in cities of refuge, so they could have been open to being killed at any time by any of the Gibeonites. They realized that blood for blood was a divine principle. Now, I'd like you just to hold your hand and go back to Numbers chapter 35. Because these Gibeonites, they might have been slaves, they might have formerly been Ammonites or Hivites, Canaanites, part of the despised races that were to be wiped out by God through Joshua. But that's all changed. And for 400 years, they've been working alongside the priesthood and the Levites. And they have learned an enormous amount about the God of Israel and come to respect that. And we know that they've been listening because of what they say here. In Numbers 35, and let's just go to verse 30. The context of Numbers 35 is dealing with the laws of murder. And that's in fact what had happened with these people. Verse 30, whoso killeth any person, the murderer shall be put to death by the mouth of witnesses, but one witness shall not testify against any person to cause him to die. Moreover, he shall take no satisfaction for the life of the murderer. You know that that phrase, he shall take no satisfaction, is again in English, in our sort of common parlance, doesn't really mean a great deal. But other translations, like the ESV, say, ye shall accept no ransom. That's why they said to David, we don't want any money from Saul or his house. Because they knew the principle that the murderer, the one who shed the blood, his blood needed to be shed. That's what God said. And you can't make other arrangements. You can't have a ransom. You can't just buy it off. They could have made an absolute fortune if they'd claimed their, you know, their price, if the nation would have paid it. But this is amazing. Look at verse 33. So ye shall not pollute the land wherein ye are, for blood, it defileth the land, and the land cannot be cleansed of the blood that is shed therein, but by the blood of him that shed it. They knew that principle very clearly. That's why they said it's not for us to put people to death, but we know when you ask us, we know that what should happen is that people from Saul's house, his house of blood, who were involved in this situation, them need to be hung up, seven men. So they didn't just make this up. This isn't mindless revenge, brothers and sisters. This is these people using what they know God has revealed. It's astounding when you read it. Look, let's read verse 34. Defile therefore not ye the land in which ye inhabit, wherein I dwell, for I, Yahweh, dwell among the children of Israel. You see, brothers and sisters, blood defiled the land. It's a sort of a strange concept to us. But we find that on a number of occasions. And the only thing that could remove that defilement on the land of blood is by the blood of the person who shed the blood in the first place, then that caused the problem. You know, in the law and the prophets, the land could be defiled by murder. Here's a classic example. It could be defiled by a criminal being left on a stake overnight and not being taken down. It could be defiled by divorce. It could be defiled by immorality and whoredoms. It could be defiled by idolatrous practices. And you think, well, how does the land, what has the land got to do with this? Why is the land so important? And why, you remember where these words came from, where did we read them earlier? Tonight, at the end of 2 Samuel chapter 21. It says, and after that, God was entreated for the land. What that's saying is that God accepted the offering for the sin that had been going on that had defiled the land. You see, the reason why God says you're defiling the land is because God gave them the land to inherit, but he dwelt there as well. And he was not able to dwell with iniquity, with murder, with all the immorality and the whoredoms and the idolatrous practices that they brought into that land. And it would defile the land so that he couldn't stay there. You see, that's actually what it's saying in verse 34. Defile therefore not the land which ye shall inhabit, wherein I dwell. I want to be there with you. And if you carry on with all this sin and do all these evil practices and break covenants, then I can't stay there. And the land is defiled. And until the land's fixed, until you fix the problem that caused that, I can't come back. Well, this is amazing because the Gibeonites knew all of that. And they asked for seven sons of Saul, the covenant number, because they'd broken the covenant. And they said, we want them hung up before Yahweh. You know, you might think, well, okay, that's a bit grisly. What do you fellas think you're doing? You know, you're getting a bit carried away now just because David came to them and said, well, what do you think I should do? You know, David was under no obligation at all to do anything they said. David asked them to try and get to the bottom of what was going on. And as he asked more and more, he found out just what these people were like. And he found they were amazingly godly people who knew their Bibles, who tried to live by them, and were in fact doing a whole lot better than much of the rest of the nation. In fact, this group of people, the Gibeonites, who later got absorbed into a bit wider group and adopted the name that they were given the name Nethinim later. You find them. We've been reading about them in the books of Ezra, Nehemiah, and Esther. Not so much Esther, I don't think, but Ezra and Nehemiah. Because they even came back out of captivity back into the land again. It's amazing. Hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years when many of the rest of the nation of Israel were completely gone, they remained faithful. It's a staggering story, really, to find that these are the people that Saul has absolutely massacred. Well, so did they say, have they got this vindictive spirit and say, okay, we want these men impaled because we want to see them up there. And so that's nothing less than that will do. You know, if we think that, brothers and sisters, we didn't read that verse correctly. We didn't actually read verse 6 correctly. He said, deliver us 7 men and we will hang them up unto Yahweh. And that sealed it for David. He saw exactly what they were saying. He knew precisely what they were thinking. Do you know where the Gibeonites got the idea of hanging a man up before Yahweh because of iniquity? We'll turn back a few pages. You're still in Numbers? Numbers 25. Let's go back to Numbers 25. Numbers 25 is the story of the idolatry of and the problems at Baal Peor. When Israel and Shittim, and they committed whoredom with the daughters of Moab. Israel, verse 3, joined himself unto Baal Peor, and the anger of Yahweh was kindled against Israel because they had defiled the land and God couldn't stay there anymore. Verse 4, and Yahweh said unto Moses, take all the heads of the people and hang them up before Yahweh against the sun, that the fierce anger of Yahweh may be turned away from Israel. Do you know what, brothers and sisters? Most of Israel didn't know that principle. And the Gibeonites here are telling David, all we want is 7 men that were involved in the particular blood. The people that were actually guilty, blood for blood, like God said, we need them hung up before Yahweh that God's anger might be turned away, not from us, but from all of your whole nation whom we love. And the nation that's tried to destroy us. What an amazing people. That's why David said, I'll do it. David immediately saw what they were driving at. He saw there was national sin here. He saw that God needed to be honoured. He knew that Moses had been told by God the way that you can deal with this situation of national sin is to hang up the culprits and placard sin for what it really is, and then his wrath will be taken away and God might once more be amongst his people. It's just absolutely astounding, isn't it, brothers and sisters, to see the mind of these Gibeonites. They're just simple slaves. And all of that seems to be foreshadowing the work of Christ and the cross, where when a man was going to be hung up before the sun for all to see, and was going to placard to the world that sin is what causes the problem, and that we can come back to God once we realise that. We'll come back to 2 Samuel 21, verse 7. So David's now left with this shockingly difficult circumstance. He's got to decide now what he's going to do. He's got to find seven men. He's already said, yes, I'll do this. He's got to find seven sons. He has got an amazingly difficult task in front of him now. You take that on, brothers and sisters. You just think for a minute what that actually meant. That David had to now go to individuals face to face and tell them their life was going to be ended because of this famine that was in the land, because God had revealed this and because of what had happened to the Gibeonite. David definitely wanted to be sure that he had chosen the right men. But we find in verse 7, the king spared Mephibosheth, the son of Jonathan, the son of Saul, because of Yahweh's oath that was between them. It's very sensible and understandable. This wasn't favoritism. David greatly respected Yahweh's oaths, unlike Saul. And was he to then go and try and appease God for Saul breaking an oath by breaking another one himself? No, of course not. So Mephibosheth wasn't even in the consideration. But the king took, after much consideration, I think after much discussion, and remember this, that he's talking to the Gibeonites. You can rest assured that if your family and your cousins and your wider extended community of servants, as you serve the nation, had been cruelly and unjustifiably slaughtered by some people, that you would have some idea about who did it. And David is no fool. And I believe he's actually talked to these men. He's found their spirit. He believes what they're saying. And he sees in them a respect for God and his principles, which is quite outstanding. So verse 8 says he took two sons of Rizpah and he took five sons of Michal. Now, in the margin it says Michal's sister, but a number of Hebrew manuscripts and the Septuagint and Syriac versions are taken up by a lot of more modern translations like the NIV, ESV and so on, and it translates that as Merab, who was. They actually have Merab in the text, which makes a lot more sense because she was married to Adriel. And it translates it like this, Merab, whom she bare to Adriel. So here's Saul's house. From what we know, and this is all the information we actually have in the scriptures, we know the name of Saul's wife, Ahinoam, and we know that she had three sons and two daughters, and then presumably a later son who was a bit younger, Ishbosheth, who was not of fighting age or didn't go out to fight when Saul was slain, because the first three there, along with Saul, were killed in battle. So there's three of Saul's sons that have already been killed. And Saul himself is not there anymore. So blood for blood is no, there's no question about that happening. And who is left? Well, we know that Ishbosheth was murdered, was assassinated. That's an interesting story too, in relation to this, if you like to chase it up later. I'm not going there now. And so he doesn't have any sons left. He's only got two daughters. Yes, but he's got a concubine. One concubine, Rizpah, and she has two sons. So these here are real sons of Saul, these two. And David took these two and the five sons of Merab. Now, we don't know whether any of these men here had descendants. They're certainly not recorded in Chronicles. They're not recorded nowhere. And it may be that Jonathan only had a five-year-old son when he was killed, and he was the eldest. It may be that these had no children.
Can I ask a question?
Hmm.
Is in verse 6 it says that seven men of his sons.
Yes.
Is that not referring to grandchildren?
It is referring to wider sons further down the line. It can be sons, can be grandsons. It's very, the Hebrew is capable of, you know, just meaning descendants almost, you know, sons and grandsons. So here's David looking around and no doubt talking and finding out. And David decides that it's going to be these five sons and these two sons here. And they are the seven. Imagine the difficulty of that decision. You know, actually, I don't think in the end that was such a difficult decision. Difficult for David because he didn't want to see anyone's life taken. But I think Rizpah here is caught in the crosshairs again of the treachery of the house of Saul. She was caught there once before with Ish-bosheth and Abner and accused, possibly falsely, earlier, and now her own sons are going to be taken from her. And we might think, well, you know, what about this principle of that's recorded in the law that a son will not be put to death for the sin of his father, and it's reiterated in the prophets as well. It's a different principle to what we read in Exodus 34. That's the consequences of sin. But do sons get put to death for the sin of their father, or the father for the sin of their sons? And God says, no, that's not the case. And I think what is actually happening here is that David had made very careful inquiry. And he had actually discovered that those five sons and those two sons of Rizpah were all involved in the massacre. Because you notice what verse 1 said? Saul and his house of blood. Verse 4 says his house. And verse 8 calls these five sons the sons of Merab, the daughter of Saul. They're not called the sons of Adriel, like you might expect. Those five sons were sons of Saul. In more ways than just genealogical descent, they were of his ilk. So it seems. So these sons must have been involved in the massacre. And David, no doubt, had carefully weighed all that evidence before he'd finally come to that. And so verse 9, he delivers them to the hands of the Gibeonites and they hanged them in the hill before Yahweh. Now just read this very carefully and think of this language. They hanged them, or they crucified them. Where did they crucify them? In the hill before Yahweh. And they fell, all seven of them together, as if there were a unity, as if there was just one man falling dead that day. And it was in the first days of barley harvest. You know when the first days of barley harvest were? Barley harvest was in the month of Abib. You know what happened in the month of Abib? What happened in the month of Abib? I can't hear. I can hear just mumble, mumble, whisper, whisper. Passover. There's some echoes here, aren't there? We'll come to this right at the end. But it was a very difficult decision there for David. And yet all along, I think he was being led by the evidence and by the spirit of the Gibeonites as to what must be done. And we know that it was right in the end. We know that David, as difficult as that path was for him to go down and to all those decisions to take, God in the end was entreated for the land. And this crucifixion was seen by God as a public recognition of the wrong so that the nation could now move on. But this is a really strange part of the story. Verse 10, and Rizpah the daughter of Aiah took sackcloth and spread it for her upon the rock. She didn't spread this for them, for the bodies. She went out to where the bodies were, and she spread it on a rock, and there she camped. From the beginning of the harvest until water dropped upon them out of heaven, and suffered neither the birds of the air to rest on them by day nor the beasts at night. You know, sackcloth is very often in the scriptures associated with affliction and the recognition of sin. And here was an acknowledgement by her of this crime. She may well have been herself innocent of it. Who knows? But she was in very deep affliction through this whole experience, having her two sons, her only two sons, taken from her. But we don't find her desperately trying to hang on to them or to stop those who are hanging or to accuse the Gibeonites. Or she's not complaining or emotionally out of control, brothers and sisters. There's this quiet devotion with this woman, a very, very sad figure that goes out to where the bodies are, and there she camps day and night. It's a heart-wrenching scene, isn't it? She couldn't prevent the shame of this public hanging, but she could protect the bodies from the ravages of animals. She could protect that sacrifice that was given to Yahweh until Yahweh actually said he had accepted it. And she kept there, brothers and sisters. She stayed there until the heavens broke and rain fell on those bodies, and then she went home. We could say, to quote another part of Scripture, she did what she could. She guarded them until the rain dropped, until God's favour returned. Do you know the start of Passover was the start of was the springtime? It was coming into the hot season, and there was going to be no substantial rains for 6 months. But when it says here the water dropped from heaven, it means absolutely cascaded. And God, because he had stopped the rain, started it at some point. And until that time came, she stayed there. God could end it at any time, but when it did eventually come, it was a clear sign of his acceptance of the atoning work of those sacrifices. You know, Rizpah's action here, brothers and sisters, is not just an act of devotion of a distraught mother. I think she too had seen something greater in this. She might not have understood everything about what was going on, but she realised that the crucifixion of her sons was part of an atonement for national sin. And she stayed out there to protect that sacrifice for the nation until God showed his favour. And she was included in that favour. She guarded the victims because she knew the whole nation depended on that sacrifice. You know, I said earlier that the land got defiled when they didn't take someone down off the cross or off a hanging. So how come they didn't take him down the first day? How come they waited till the rain came? Well, the land was already defiled. And the land wasn't defiled just by a simple, single individual who'd done something wrong, a criminal who was hanging on a cross. The land was defiled with national sin, with the breaking of a serious covenant, with the murder of a people that God had wanted to save. And so those bodies stayed on that hanging until God was satisfied that the whole nation had come to grips with the seriousness of sin and how it pervades through the nation. And how many who must have known what was going on, or at least bits of it, never did a thing. And then, when he deemed that was time, he let the rain come. You know, when David heard that, verse 11, he moved. He was actually moved by what Rizpah had done, because he knew what it meant. He knew why she had gone out there. He knew that She was honouring God's requirement. She was accepting that her sons had to be killed for the sake of the nation. And she was prepared to wait for God's favour. And so David goes and gets the bones of Jonathan and Saul and his other sons and the bones of the seven, both of which had been hung. And all these hung bones now came together as one. And he gave them a proper burial. He gave them a proper burial, brothers and sisters, in respect for Rizpah. But there's another reason as well. Because in 1 Samuel 24, verse 20 to 24, which we won't turn to now, David made a covenant with Saul at a time when Saul was absolutely out to get his neck. And when he realized his folly, he pleaded with David to make a covenant with him that he would not destroy his name out of his father's house. And so now David not only gives these sons of Saul a decent burial, but he honours the covenant that he'd made with Saul to not cut off his name out of his father's house. And he took Saul's bones and the sons' bones and he buried them in the burying place of his father Kish. This is a man, brothers and sisters, after God's own heart. This is a man who was chased from one end of the country to the other for 12 years by this man Saul, this madman, who very often was in absolute desperation, thinking his life was going to be taken at any moment. But he was grieved for this man. He was grieved for Saul and for his house. He never wanted to see any of this happen. And the least he could do was to give him an honourable burial. It's a remarkable story, brothers and sisters, and some remarkable people here. The Gibeonites, in their spiritual approach, Rizpah in her acceptance of God's will despite her personal grief. And David is a giant, brothers and sisters, wise, courageous, steering the nation through this most horrific difficulty. And he satisfies the Gibeonites and strengthens their place in Israel. We'll come back to that later. He honoured his oath to Jonathan. He respected and enacted his vow with Saul. He responded to the spirit of Rizpah. He encouraged her. He upheld all of Yahweh's principles in the law. And he brought God's favour back into the nation through this atoning sacrifice. And after that, the record says at the end, God was entreated for the land. I'm going to leave you with this. I'm not going to talk about it. But there's shadows there that we've already heard tonight. And if you'd like a copy of that, there's a few down here. There's about 15 down there. And if anyone would like the slides emailed to them, you can put your name on a sheet here at the front and I'll email them to you. But just as you go away tonight, just think about the implications of this story and its wider outreach in the purpose of God and what it was foreshadowing through what seems to be a most unusual set of circumstances, but that highlights some amazing characters.